Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show, also your hosts throughout the week on our website and podcast. Pretty consistently updating everybody on market commentary and a lot of company interviews again, because look, there is a lot of news coming out of these companies, even if broadly in the resource space, these companies are still more or less kind of stuck in trading ranges at best. We're going to start off the first two segments here looking at a wide range of markets as we are chatting with Rick Bensignor. Second half of the show, we're going to dive a bit more into some of the larger production companies when we chat with Joe Mazumdar. As mentioned, though, we are kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail side, Rick writes the In the Know Trader and also a piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. Now, Rick, we're going to talk about your 2022 forecast that you sent out to your clients early on this month. Before we get into some of the markets, I just want your general comments on the macro environment. We have a lot of changes coming this year with the Fed, and, well, we just don't know what's going to happen with COVID. A lot of moving parts here, as there always are heading into a year, but one thing we've been hearing is just how hard it is to have any sort of defined outlook for the macro environment this year. What's your general assessment of macro factors that need to be considered and how hard, quite frankly, it is to forecast forward this year?
Hi, Corey. Hi, Jack. The biggest factors to deal with, I mean, they're somewhat obvious. You've got a more hawkish Fed, and that is a very predominant factor to deal with. And the faster pace of the tapering of bond purchases, the markets are already factoring in 425 basis point interest rate hikes this year. So what that effect has on the markets, obviously COVID, whether it's the current knowledge of the Delta and the Omicron variants and what they do, as well as if any other variant comes along. Omicron came out of nowhere. And so, you know, who knows what potentially comes next, and is it going to be, let's say, better or worse than what Omicron was, which so far is proving to be less damaging than the Delta variant was, which was less damaging than the original COVID virus itself. So, you know, you've got all those issues to deal with on the health front. You have the administration's attempt to still get some type of infrastructure deal done, and whether or not it's ultimately going to come about in any type positive way for the country. Let's even keeping the politics part out of it, just whether or not this will actually get done and help America kind of rebuild itself. There are so many places it is desperately needed. You've got political tensions with China and Russia kind of at the worst that they've been in quite some time. And whether or not any of that kind of gets out of hand or not, or things that we need to deal with on the macro front. I think part of the volatility that you're going to see this year has to do with the unknowing of those various topics. And I don't think it'll be as easy to make money this year as, let's say, 2021 was, which, despite several times the market selling off, we never got more than, in S&P terms, a 5.5% pullback, and we closed right near all-time highs, so ending out 2021. So we're still only, what, S&P is, what, 3% or so away from all-time highs, NASDAQ about 5 or 6. Still not bad, considering how far we've come.
Well, Rick, you're right. We're still hovering near all-time highs in the general markets, and many markets are still trucking right along. There is a little bit of indecision to start the year, but that makes sense with the macro backdrop you just outlaid. But one question I have is, we just saw a pretty hot inflation reading again. Things have still trended a little higher, a 7% CPI reading and a 9.7% PPI reading. Do you think we'll start seeing that taper down as the rest of the year unfolds in kind of a disinflationary pattern? And how does that affect the bond markets the way you're looking at it?
I don't think that we're going to get down to more typical type inflation numbers. So we may taper down from the 7% level. I suspect we can, but it'll take some time. And, you know, we're not going back towards what used to be the Fed's target of 2% type inflation. It would probably surprise me if we get much under 4% or so, but we certainly can pull back from what we've seen. You know, the interest rate environment is such that we came out of the starting gate this year with rates moving from 1.51 to in less than 2 weeks, you know, we got to 1.81. So a huge upsurge in rates. Now we pulled back to about 170 and today we're at 1.75. So you still got this upward edge in rates. And to me, the main level to kind of look at to think that rates are going to continue to the upside is probably a breakout above 1.86%. That's a level that I've targeted going all the way back to the beginning of when I did my forecast for 2021. 1.86 was the level that I was focusing on the upside that yields would need to get above to really turn the game around. So I'm still thinking that that's probably about the right level. And if you get that type move and a further move beyond that, a few things become evident just from looking at the charts. One is you have an inverted head and shoulders looking at 10-year yields chart, which if you get above 1.9% and really kind of hold above there, you're talking about an eventual measured target of 3.25%, which was the last major high that yield saw. I think it was 2000, maybe 17 or 18 before yields fell all the way down to all-time lows. And on a shorter term basis, getting up above 186 to, let's just say, 1.9%, targets 225 to about 2.5%. And I think that's very likely that we're going to see that happen this year. I don't think 3.25 necessarily is going to happen, but I do think we're going to see 2.25, 2.5. And yet, look, we still haven't broken out to the upside. So it's still kind of an early call. But I do think in general, rates will make their way higher. And therefore, that is going to affect the dollar, the stocks, and, you know, essentially every other market.
Well, Rick, the question I have is, if inflation's at 7% and the rates are creeping up to 1.7, let's say 1.8 that they got up to, why would anybody want to hold a 10-year treasury note when they're getting eroded by that much inflation? The negative real rates are still so extreme. Do you think that'll escalate even more selling out of the bond market?
I think it probably will. And to answer your question, I've been in print now for well over a year saying, why would anyone want to be a buyer of a U.S. 10-year treasury bond? But I say that in respect to an individual. Obviously, pension plans, insurance companies, there are needed streams that are guaranteed to run businesses, and better said than guaranteed is known streams, in order to effectively run a business. So you're always going to have certain demand for those instruments, regardless of what type yield they give an investor. But for the everyday person, the only reason you would buy it is an alternative to cash as compared to, let's say, being invested in the stock market if you're concerned that the stock market is going to lose value. Which, of course, given the run that we've seen since the March 2020 low, certainly, you know, we could lose value this year. I don't think so. My 2022 forecast was suggesting a 7 to 13% return in the S&P this year, much closer to half, if not like, 35% or so of what we saw last year. But that still would be traditionally higher than the average return. And it wouldn't be shocking if the market lost money this year. But I think despite the headwinds that I've listed, the general economy is still solid. There are tailwinds when it comes to, well, it depends on how you want to look at valuation, but I think generally the market still has reasons that over time it should increase in value. And, you know, look, if you got a 10% pullback this year, it's not the worst thing, given how much the market's moved up, not only since the March 2020 bottom, but even since the, you know, great financial crisis that ended in 2009. Not the worst thing in the world to have, you know, some type of pullback. But do I think this is the end of the whole bull market? I don't. The fact that the Fed is no longer going to have easy money out there is definitely a drag on potential returns. But I don't think that has to fuel the whole beginning to a bear market. And I don't think when it comes to the S&P that we are going to be in a 20% or more pullback in the next year or two. I don't think so.
So, Rick, I think that's important to note because, look, we look at what's going on in the bond market and yields are trending higher. And what's significant to me is that I'm seeing the 10-year recently when it broke to, I believe, 1.8%. That was the highest level that we had seen pre-pandemic. So that's early 2020. That's saying something about how the world is potentially, I guess, recovering. But boy, oh boy, do we hear a lot of comments saying the system can't withstand higher rates. There's too much debt out there, too much leverage. The market's going to fall on its face. The Fed just can't hike rates, and rates, quite frankly, the market can't move rates up that much higher. Doesn't sound like you subscribe to that theory. It is very gloom and doom, that theory, but look, we are hearing a lot of that.
I do think it's a doom and gloom type scenario that people, the ones fearing all this, are leaning on. I think the market can handle higher rates. I'm not talking about the U.S. 10-year going to 7%, but could the overall market handle 2.5% to 3% over the next couple of years? I think it can, especially if, and this is a big if the Fed does it carefully in moving rates. I think because rates are so low traditionally, there is room here to get higher, and it's somewhere probably between 3% to 4% ultimately that I think getting above, and I haven't done the work to say if it's 3% or if it's 4%, but my guess is somewhere in there becomes the greater inflection point for if the markets can handle higher rates. But until that level, I don't think it has to be a major drag on the equity market. And as rates move higher, that implies that bonds are selling off, which of course means sellers are selling their actual bonds. That money has to go somewhere. I'm not saying it's a one-for-one ratio, but certainly some of that money is going to find its way into the equity market. And that does add, you know, an underlying kind of bottom to stocks. But I think people are, the same type people are saying it's impossible for the market to handle that are probably the same type people who are always bearish and looking for any reason to be a bear. See, I'm not always bullish. I play both sides of the market depending upon, you know, when and if I need to. And there's plenty of times in my career I have been very vocal on the bear side. But right now, I continue to be bullish in general. I do have kind of a fail-safe level that's not all that far away in the S&P. And that's not to go to, you know, 100% cash. It's a level that if we break on a Friday close, and the more we break it, the more likely it's the right thing. Currently in the S&P, that level is at 45.16. So as long as we continue to see weekly closes above that level, then I'm okay staying in stocks in general. What we're seeing is more rotation than anything else, with tech, you know, bearing the brunt of the outflows. But when I look at the market just in general terms, so I'm not individual stocks, because, you know, breadth is giving a very different story. If you look at the breadth of the S&P, it's a very different story than looking at the S&P itself. If you look at the breadth in NASDAQ, it's abysmal. It topped out late last winter of 2021. It's been down pretty consistently since. And yet, as we said earlier, the Nasdaq's only 5% from all-time highs. But the average Nasdaq stock has gotten pummeled. So it's the big cap names that make the S&P index and the Nasdaq index look better than the components that make up those indices. So if you're in QQQ or spiders, you're doing much better, most likely, than if you have a whole bunch of stocks in your portfolio. Those, you know, you could easily be down 30 to 50 or more percent on lots of individual names, whereas the S&P is 3% from all-time high.
Rick, let's talk about some of that rotation that we have seen in the markets out of growth into value, but also the fact that, as you just outlined too, with something like the NASDAQ, most of the stocks are actually down, but if you're in the broad markets, then you've actually still done decently, or at least last year, especially with the weak breadth, just the passive investors did way better than people trying to pick usually a few stocks and ride those higher. What sectors do you think could outperform? And look, is this environment still favoring the passive investor, where the broad averages, you might as well just play those rather than trying to handpick select stocks?
I mean, right now, I think, yes, you're going to be better, or at least you've been certainly better in 2021 in the ETFs that represent the market than in the individual stocks. This year, I mean, to start the year, we're in consumer discretionary. I'm slightly above benchmark weight there. Technology, I'm above benchmark weight. That's the one that's hurting right now. Industrials, I'm above benchmark weight. Materials, just a tiny bit above benchmark. Energy, I have a full double exposure to. It represents less than 3% in the S&P. In our January 1st issue, 0711, we have a 6% exposure there. So we are double, and it's up. Coming into today, it's up 13.5% on the year versus an S&P that's down 2.2% or so. So it's certainly been a very good overweight, but again, it's still, you know, a very small piece of the portfolio. We're not in staples. I do like healthcare. They have not done well this year, and I have I'm decently overweight financials. So those are the sectors I kind of have exposure to now. Clearly, tech is the one that's hurting the most. Because of its weight in the S&P, it's 28% in the S&P. And, you know, for a lot of PMs and people who do like what I do, it's so often critical to get the tech portion right because it's the largest sector in the S&P. So I may need to trim a little out of tech, but I'm not giving up on tech yet as a whole sector. But I may need to just trim down how much overweight I have in it, just simply because, and same type thing going forward, unless I hated the tech sector, I probably always have to have exposure in it. I just may be at whatever the benchmark weighting is, and then I just take or lose whatever it gives each month, but it doesn't hurt me relative to, you know, the overall exposure basis. It's just, right now, I do have an overweight in tech, and you know, that's the only piece that I'm really concerned about, wondering if I'm going to stay with.
Yeah, Rick, tech is definitely a big part of most portfolio managers' portfolios, and it's something that everybody keeps a close eye on. It'll be interesting to see, because there is a little bit of a dichotomy between the very top big cap tech names and that second and third tier tech names. There's a bit of a divergence there, so it'll be interesting to see how that continues to develop. But you also brought up energy. I'd love to get your thoughts on 2022, what you expect in the energy markets.
I actually think that energy likely made its long-term relative performance bottom in 2021. And I started getting into it, I think, in summertime on the pullback. I think it was August or so, either June or August. I don't quite remember, but I know it was summer that we went overweight, and I continue to be overweight to the point that I say, like, you know, I've been double overweight at this point. I like how it's acting. Obviously, the clean energy side has gotten beaten down badly, which has hurt a lot of people. I think that's a temporary type thing. The fossil fuel side has actually done much better as of recent. But when I, and natural gas had a very good year last year too. When I look at the whole complex across the board, I think it's a place you want to have exposure to. Just to put it into context, if you were to have bought the XLE in the year 2000, you, I think, are still underwater 21 years later. The only S&P sector that you would have lost money in 20 years, you know, everywhere else made, obviously, tech and consumer discretionary and financials had huge gains over those times. But energy has just been a horrific sector for so long. And a couple of years along the way, it outperformed, but it has been a disaster for 20 plus years. And I actually think it's got its relative bottom in place. So I use pullbacks now in its relative performance to add more exposure. And I think it will slowly, you know, make its way higher. Whether or not oil gets to $100 or not is yet to be seen. It does measure, you know, if we break out to new highs, it does measure up to about $101, anywhere up to $109, which certainly would help the sector. But look, over time, there is a shift going on and committed to by not only many individual U.S. companies, but also to different countries across the globe to shift towards, you know, cleaner fuels and to become far more carbon free over the next anywhere from 5 to 25 or 30 years. So I do think that that adds infrastructure into the, you know, new building, new infrastructure into the growth in the energy sector going forward. So it is a sector that I think I will continually have exposure in on an overweight basis. And for me now, you know, the challenge is how much do you put into the clean energy space versus the more traditional fossil fuel side of things.
So, Rick, what is your thought on that, though? Because that is kind of the debate that's going on out there, is that governments seem to want to move more to the clean side of energy. But A, that takes time. It takes infrastructure. It takes a lot of money. And we're not there yet. And to get there, we actually need to, it seems like, use fossil fuels to help build that side out. Is there a general timeline that you're thinking a major shift could happen where finally the fossil fuel sector loses its lead?
Well, you know, it's funny. In 2020, it lost its lead big time. And then 2021, it got a lot of it back. You know, if I look at an ETF, and there are lots of kind of clean energy ETFs. One of them I kind of frequently look at is PBW. It's the Wilder Hill Clean Energy ETF. And that peaked first quarter last year. But it ran from the low 20s in share price to over almost 140 in less than a year, right? So it did a sevenfold, or let's call it six plus fold multiplier in a year, and now it's given half of that back. I think going forward, you're going to have to still have some type of balance between the two, but I don't think you totally go all in on clean or go all in on fossil type of stuff. You got to have exposure to both, because at any given time, either one can take the lead back. And, you know, I'll play that when it comes. Right now, I don't have a signal to say, like, go buy PBW or, let's say, TAN, which is the solar ETF, TAN. I don't have the signal yet. We're getting close to a level that is potentially a signal. I don't have it yet. So for the time being, you know, I'm just going to kind of stay invest across both. But in general, I like the sector. And, you know, I do think energy will surprise people going forward, because it's still generally underowned because of its 20-year horrific track record. And portfolio managers are going to be reticent into, you know, really putting much beyond benchmark weighting in. But I do think it's a place that you're going to see decent returns and outperformance from in, you know, perhaps the next 10 years.
Well, Rick, let's shift over to the commodity sector then, because there's a lot of them needed for that clean energy build out, things like copper and nickel for batteries, lithium, et cetera, but then also gold. Just what's your outlook on the commodities from the base metals, battery metals, to gold and silver?
Well, the commodities in general, I'm still relatively bullish. I think they're in the last few months of 2021, where you saw a pullback in commodity prices, was just a pullback and a much larger up move over time. So I do like commodities. I actually grew up in the commodity industry. I was a floor trader in the pits for my first dozen years out of college. I know the industry well, and I'm used to trading them. It's not for everyone, but as a sector to invest in, rather than looking in terms of, gee, should I be long, corn at any given day? If you look at the sector, and there are some ETFs that broadly cover the commodity sector, like GSG, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index ETF, I generally want exposure to this group and use pullbacks to get into them, because I do think over time it's still going to be a decent sector. The dollar itself has continuously paused over 96.5, the dollar index, that is. It's pulled back to, I think, what, we're in the near 95-ish, let me see. There we go, 95.22 or so is the cash index. So it has pulled, it got up to 97 or so, so it's pulled back a bit. I think we probably get down to 94 to 92 on this pullback, and then I probably look to buy the dollar for retest back towards recent highs. Last year, predominantly the dollar moved higher, and that did not help gold. And at the same time, massive inflation numbers should have helped gold and didn't. Gold was down last year. It's still not something that I have any significant overweight to. I do have some gold exposure. I will probably always have some gold exposure. But right now, I actually favor gold miners over gold itself. And there are different times that the stocks are better to be into, and other times bullion is. Right now, I like the stocks a little better. Gold's been pretty sleepy, and there hasn't been a heck of a lot to do. And when you get a day like today where the dollar's up 43 pips, it's not, gold's down $5-6 right now. It's going to put some pressure on. But gold in and of itself, too, has not acted the way you would expect given the inflation numbers. And that's somewhat of a concern, that it's losing investor interest in favor of perhaps crypto or some other type of hedge that potentially gives you a better return. And obviously, crypto's had a fantastic year in 2021. And even though Bitcoin is significantly off its all-time highs, it's around $43,000 now off of a high of, what, $68,000 or so. You still had good returns last year, whereas gold lost you money. So as far as a hedge, it hasn't been a real good hedge as of recent, and there are other places people are looking to be in. So I'm kind of sleepy towards gold. It just hasn't done much. It's getting closer towards the apex of its triangle when it comes in charting terms. And we'll see which way it goes. I know basically it's really important it holds above 1675 if you're bullish.
Yes, it is. And hey, you're spot on. Gold has been a very boring market. Argument being that that is actually sometimes what gold is supposed to be, a bit of a boring market, some sort of a safety market. But investors don't care about safety right now, and they don't care about boring, right, Rick? Have we seen a big enough change in investor psychology that, you know what, investors, they're based so much year to year, quarter to quarter on performance, that they don't have a whole lot of room in their active trading accounts for something that is boring, like gold?
So, it's very different if you're an individual investor as compared to a professional money manager, because a professional money manager has benchmarks that they attempt to at least match, if not do better than, each year. An individual investor doesn't have that. So if you're a PM, you are much more living the quarter to quarter existence within the existence of any given fiscal year that you're benchmarked to. And if you badly underperform, chances are you're going to lose assets under management, because money moved towards the people who seem to be doing it right at any given time. And that's not always a good thing, too, because individuals tend to chase high performance. But, you know, I'd be much more satisfied in finding a money manager who outperforms, let's just say, the S&P by, you know, 3% every year on a consistent basis than the one who'd be outperforming the S&P by 10% in 1 year, but might underperform by 7% the next year. So I don't like chasing performance. I like to look for consistency in a money manager. And it's because, you know, there's a very different lifespan to the thinking process when you're actively managing money. An individual can afford to sit with gold for years, even if it does nothing. Yeah, you're trading off. There's opportunity cost there for other things that would be making money. But the real reason you're owning gold is not because you think gold is going to make you a ton of money, but it's a minor hedge against other things going wrong. It's not going to save your rear end if the market, if the, you know, stock market gets killed, you have 3 to 5% of your portfolio in gold. It's not going to help you a ton, but it is somewhat of a hedge against, you know, disaster. And it depends on how much of your overall portfolio would you want to have hedged at any given time. You know, if you were 50% in gold and 50% in stocks, if stocks sold off, chances are you'd do okay, you know, on your gold investment. But if you take last year and as an example where gold was down on the year and the S&P was up 27% or so, you know, then you only made half of what you could have. So I just stick with a little gold as, you know, I never think of, thank God I have 3% of my portfolio in gold in case there's a stock crash, I'm okay. Now I'm smart enough to know 3% in gold is not going to save me from anything. But over time, gold has, you know, moved higher. It's not all that many years ago. I mean, you know, when I put that in context of a long-term investor, you know, 10 years ago, gold was a heck of a lot lower. And so you have made money being long gold, as well as the fact that in theory, it's some type of hedge. But it's, you know, we're starting to see challenges to how much of a hedge it really is.
Very good points there, Rick. Always great chatting with you as well. Thanks for really summarizing your 2022 outlook in a number of different markets. I always love hearing what you have to say because, yeah, you're not biased towards any certain market or any certain sector, and you're just letting the markets dictate kind of where the money is flowing and understanding that psychology plays a lot into these moves as well. Rick, thank you, as always, for your time. I always look forward to having you on the show, and I appreciate you sharing your thoughts again on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend, Rick.
You too, guys. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, everybody. Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in those first two segments, boy, oh boy, we covered a lot of different markets with Rick Bensignor. In these last two segments, we are chatting with Joe Mazumdar, editor over at Exploration Insights. And we are going to be focusing almost exclusively on the resource sector, mostly in terms of the stocks, and a lot starting off here with some of the developers and producers of precious metals and even down into some of the other commodities. Fact of the matter is, we've heard the argument, whether it's precious metals or base metals, whatever metal you want, that, look, metals prices are generally higher than they were many years ago. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, a decade ago. And you would think that a lot of these companies should be benefiting share price wise. Majors, they've done maybe a little bit better recently, but a lot of these developers, boy, oh boy, they really continue to struggle. And it seems like a lot of investors continue to turn away or at least ignore this sector. this ties in a lot with the inflation narrative, where inflation continues to pick up. We are recording this about halfway through the week. And look, we just got the inflation data of 7%. When inflation is higher, that does eat away at some of the margins of these producers. Joe, in a broad sense, what do you think matters for investors right now when they are looking at developers and producers in metals, understanding that inflation is still rising?
Yes, thanks for having me. In terms of inflation being a central theme that you know was spoken about last year as being more transitory because of COVID and issues with the supply chain. Now that we're seeing 7% in the States, but we're seeing inflation in the Eurozone. We're seeing also, inflation in China, but not to the same extent, if you believe the numbers, at about 2%. And even Japan, which was deflationary forever, is also seeing a modicum of inflation. So globally, all large economies, everyone's seeing inflation. And so what that's doing to the prices is making people, less positive about real rates. Real rates actually coming up, and then gold price might come down. And so that sentiment right now for the gold sector is negative. In terms of costs, what we're seeing is margins are contracting for gold companies. Like we always say that the gold price still is good for producers because they have book their reserves at much lower prices. Even for the developers, we're seeing scoping studies and technical reports that are coming out at prices $200 to $300 per ounce lower than spot price. But what we're also seeing is cost escalation, not only capital but operating, that are squeezing the internal rates of return on the development projects and also the margins for producers. And that's a trend that is not positive for precious metal producers going into 2022.
Well, Joe, let's stick with the producers first, and then we can pivot to the developers. Some of the narrative has been that, hey, with these high gold prices, they're banking money, they should be out growing their projects, taking over other companies. But people also forget that their cost of labor is going up, their cost of their fuel is going up, the cost of cement and steel and everything else is going up. Do you think that's why the generalist investors are looking at the precious metal sector maybe with a different set of lenses and saying, hey, I could see your margins still being good, but trending downward. So therefore, maybe that's keeping a lid on the prices. Is that maybe a force that we're seeing in the marketplace as regards to the producing companies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we can talk about the balance sheets, which are good. We can talk about the reserves, which are very conservative. But the issue is that if you were looking for margin expansion, that argument probably ended sometime around the third quarter of last year. And so I've been tracking margins for base metal producers and for precious metal producers. And for precious metal producers, the average margin of a number of companies that I was tracking was well over 50% back in the fourth quarter of 2020. Now those have sort of contracted to 45% in the third quarter of 21, but that doesn't include the sustaining capital, the increases, potentially development costs increases if they had any development projects that would hit them. Meanwhile, the nickel and the copper producers and the base metal producers, their margins on average have been going up from about 30-35% to about 40%. So their margins are expanding because the price of the products they're producing are going up higher than their own cost increases due to labor, due to energy, due to goods and services. And there was an interesting, Bloomberg put out the components of the inflation, and it's everything. It's not just this thing or that thing. It's goods and services, it's energy, it's labor. And labor was the thing that just has been coming out in the last couple of quarters. Labor is becoming more on the forefront with respect to the cost escalation, much tighter labor markets globally.
So, Joe, when you're looking at analyzing some of these companies, all of these developers, producers, they have economic studies out. They have a lot of data on their projects. But when you see any of these studies from 2-3 years ago, can you trust any of the numbers right now?
Well, what we're dealing with now is that a study that's, let's say, stale in 2 to 3 years, you could just say, oh, hey, you know, they should see 15% cost increase, 20% cost increase. So you could do that over the capital number, the operating number, what have you, and put that into your discounted cash flow model. But what we're also seeing is changes in scope. And so a scoping change is different, where you're not even building to the feasibility plan or the technical report. You're building a completely different project, which has its own increases as well. And that might be because the old report was in 2018. They've done more work and optimized it, and suddenly they're going to do something completely different. So overall, just basic is when you are looking at development companies, look at the date of the technical report, knowing that most of the quotes and the estimates driving their cost estimates might be even 6 months to a year before the actual published date of the report. So you got a bit of a lag there as well. And most of the inflation that we've seen has been happening in the last 2 to 3 quarters. So that's where we're seeing a lot of it happen. So if they've already got a lot of the long lead items already bought, purchased, you know, they're probably fine, but then they're still exposed to the labor costs if it's not a fixed contract. And now it looks like a lot of these contractors and builders are trying to avoid the fixed contracts so they don't eat the inflation. So now both parties are exposed to it. So those are the sort of things you got to look at. But coming back, what we're also looking at is if you're looking for a gold development project, you know, their ability to pay back that higher capital and generate better IRR is challenged in this gold price environment, plus the escalating costs. So that's a bit of a challenge. If you're producing base metals or something else, you still have the potential that the commodity you're actually producing will might go up higher than your costs increase. So you might still be able to expand your margin, and you might still be able to, you know, generate higher IRRs. Because we got to think right now is that we still have permitting issues. There's still geopolitical issues globally. Like Chile's got a new left-wing president. Peru has had one for a while. Ecuador, you know, still has its issues. And it's not that easy to permit in many states, ignoring Nevada. And so all of that put pressure on actually generating a development project. So the few that actually get built or permitted, there's not that many of them. And so people will look at that and say, well, let's build this. But it's more problematic, I would say, for precious metal companies right now that are building those sort of assets than for base metal companies or any other kind of metal. Because right now, as you pointed out originally, that a lot of these commodity prices have come up. And that's what's driving inflation. You know, but that's not, if you're producing gold, that's not what driving inflation. That's a different sort of commodity than something like copper, nickel, and what have you.
Joe, that's an interesting distinction, because you're right. If you're a base metals company and your base metal is going up in tandem with everything else, then you're not feeling the brunt of the inflationary pressures and cost inputs as much as a precious metals company would be. But you brought up an interesting point there about the scoping changes. Sometimes companies are having to do midstream, and maybe they've got to adjust, you know, the back end of their mill. Maybe they've got to put in a different decline. Maybe they've got to adjust where their tailings pit was. There's times where they're moving on the fly, and when they're doing these scoping changes, it's at a lot different price than the market was expecting, because the market wasn't expecting it and it wasn't part of the plan. So how should investors navigate, and how should even companies navigate the inevitable changes that are going to come up in a mining company's plan?
Yeah, the thing is that, you know, trying not to surprise the market is good. So if you already see cost inflation, you're already projecting a scoping change, basically let people know. But the problem is some analysts don't embed that in their plan right away, and they wait for something more formal before they do anything. like Arrow Copper has been tracking down after they had a significant capital increase on their copper project in Brazil. And basically, I mean, their big scoping change was changing the diameter of the 1.5 kilometer shaft that they were building. I think that was like they were going to build it to a certain diameter, but then they found out that that diameter of 4.2 meters needed to be like 6.3 meters, such that when they got down to the bottom, they could still keep going because they hit, you know, interesting results deeper than they were thinking that they would hit. And so that was a positive in terms of an exploration discovery, but a negative in terms of capital, because suddenly the shaft between cost inflation and scoping change doubled from 65 million to 130 million. You know, so they might have told the street, hey, it looks like we need a higher diameter shaft, but then the analysts may not have known, you know, what does that look like? Is that doubling the cost? Is that 30% increase? What is it? So they would all sit back and wait for that. And unfortunately, you know, it wasn't embedded in their prices. And so the share price, took a big hit because it was like it was unknown. And so that same similar sort of thing happened with Argonaut and Magino in terms of what people had modeled and what ended up happening. Pure Gold's another example of that. We've seen several examples of that with development companies changing on the fly and at the same time getting hit by cost inflation. And when you're not producing any cash, that's even more of a problem because you can run out of money and then you'd have to go to the equity markets and nobody wants to give you any money. So that is a risk right now.
So Joe, how do you broadly look at these developers or even producers from an investment angle? Because one of the, I guess, bullish comments you could make is that if we do start to see a turn, especially in precious metals, or even with the base metals that have done pretty well, look, investors, the large investors should get into these larger companies first, and that can provide the bump higher. Some of the base metal companies, they're already doing quite well. The odd precious metals company producer is doing quite well, but a lot of these developers have really struggled. Do you think a bottom is near, and how do you view them as investments?
Well, the thing is about when you do a development company that's non-cash flowing and they're building a project, you got to think about, well, what are they actually going to produce, and is there money out there that will help support that commodity? You know, that's really like, where are they going to get their funding from? You know, who's backing them? And if you've got solid shareholders and a solid debt, you know, helping them fund it, then you could say, oh yeah, well, it looks like this one's going to get built. But what's happening with the M&A right now is that most of the M&A, you know, apart from Great Bear, I would say, has been mostly for operations. Like Pretium and Newcrest and that. Companies that acquire, they'd rather pay a premium on a producing asset that you don't have to permit, you don't have any risk of development, you don't have any other social license to operate issues because they're already operating. So they'd rather pay the premium on an operating asset. So the goal for a development company now should be to actually build it. And that should be what you want to do. Those people that want to show they're going to build to get taken out because they really don't have the capacity to build is the ones you want to avoid, because they might be forced to build, but they may not have any capacity to do it. And then they will be the ones that run into even more trouble because they don't know what they're doing. But still, they might get funded by, let's say, somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. So those are definitely the ones you want to avoid. When you look at the development project, you look at the people behind it. What is their experience developing that kind of project in this kind of environment? And those people should get funded, because like we talked about before, there's not a lot of development projects out there. And if we're going to have, especially in base metals, a shortage of metals, then, you know, these projects need to get built.
Well, Joe, I'm glad you got into M&A activity there and whether developers should try to take the project forward on their own or wait to get taken over. We have seen a slew of takeover offers ever since the Kirkland Lake Agnico Eagle kind of kicked off the thing. We've seen a number of them, the Caliber Fiore deal, the Hochschild Amarillo deal, the Pretium takeover by Newcrest, which was a major one for the sector, and then the Great Bear takeover. All of those were single asset takeovers of a project that made sense. But my question is, do you think a lot of the mid-tiers in particular are looking at projects that they wanted to bolt on with a more skeptical lens now because of these cost inputs? And are they more likely to take over a project, you know, Great Bear aside, are they more likely to take over a project like a Pretium or like a Fiore that's already in production because they don't have that risk and that capital risk of and the construction risk? It's already behind them at that point. Do you think that's going to shape the kind of companies that are taken over?
Well, that's what we've been seeing up to this point for different reasons, because people didn't want to get involved in the development. They didn't want to get involved in the permitting risk and all that. They would rather just buy an operation. And we saw that in not only in gold, like you said, with Newcrest and Bruce Jack, Hochschild. Actually, they bought this thing in Amarillo, but that was actually development. But their problem was, you know, geopolitically, that there was the risk of their operations, like in Peru, like in Immaculada, I think, being shut down because of social license to operate. And so they were looking for some diversification geopolitically, and they chose this asset that they could build in Brazil. So each company will do what they need to do, handling geopolitical risk, which was Hochschild. Newcrest was expanding their footprint in British Columbia. Agnico and Kirkland expanding scale and to stay in low geopolitical risk jurisdictions. And the Chinese, let's not forget that one, with Golden Star in West Africa. And what was interesting that I saw with the base metals was I saw a lot of private equity that held the assets, selling them to producers. So we had that Matz selling it to Sandfire in Spain. We saw like the Kambanga Nickel selling a stake of their project to BHP. You know, Sibanye bought a nickel and a copper project from Appian in Brazil. So you see some of these private equity companies that have been holding, you know, sort of lower margin projects in different price environments that are now selling, and producers are taking those over now because they want an operation and they wanted somebody to build it for them, somebody to operate it and get through all that, and now they'll take it over at a premium. And so that's happening in the private, or has happened in the private equity sector. And so are we going to see that happen with some of these public companies? It's harder to do in the public sector because investors have a probably a shorter term view of things than private equity. But private equity has done well over this last cycle, being able to hold on to assets when nobody wanted them, buying them low, and now selling them to producers that lack development projects that want operations.
All right, Joe, a lot of great comments here on the developers, and now trickling down into some of the juniors or explorers. What about the explorers? Because you do cover a lot of them at the Exploration Insights letter. Look, the explorers, they've been under a fair bit of pressure right now, whether they have big drill programs or small drill programs. A lot of the explorers seem to be getting sold off, and we are generally seeing the financing environment tighten here. What's your general strategy or outlook for a lot of the exploration and junior plays?
I think it's going to continue to be tough, especially for the precious metals companies that don't have a significant access to capital. So all those people that might have, looked negatively at prospect generators or other companies that joint venture their projects and use other people's money, that might come back into vogue because they wouldn't have to go back to the capital markets as much as somebody who is trying to drive and advance a project 100% on their own. That was a great environment several years ago, up till probably Q3 last year. Now it's probably going to get harder to finance. So all those people that raised enough money to generate significant catalysts, that's all fine. But those people that didn't raise enough money for the next field season and were waiting to do that January, February this year, that's probably a little bit more problematic, depending if it's precious metals versus copper, nickel, and some of these other commodities that might see more people. Like last year, we saw a significant increase in financings, mostly driven by gold, mostly driven by people exploring for gold in Canada, Australia, and the US. We probably will see that diminish in 2022. But I don't know if that's going to be entirely offset, which I doubt, by financing of your copper projects, your nickel projects, your lithium projects, your what have you projects, which there are people interested in. But I don't think the investment demand is as high as for the gold and silver sector. So, because it doesn't translate usually a lot of these people that are into gold and silver that suddenly turn around and start investing in nickel or something else.
Well, Joe, as far as the exploration budgets, some of these companies still are cashed up, and there seems to be two camps. There seems to be the more micro-cap explorers that maybe they've got a 5,000, maybe even a 10,000 meter program, and they seem to move wildly on these drill results because they are earlier stage. But we're also seeing these other companies doing 40,000, 60,000, 100,000, almost upwards of 200,000 meters of drilling in a year, and their share price doesn't really move much. Their market cap may grow, but their share price doesn't, and they're adding, you know, potentially far more resources in the ground, but they're also spending quite a bit more money. Which side of that equation are you more interested in, the small microcaps that could maybe make a discovery, or the larger companies building out and de-risking deposits that are growing?
Yeah, so different risk and reward. So it's not like I'm not interested in either. It's just, you know, different. So when you're talking about the grassroots explorer with the 5 to 10,000 meter program, if I look at it and see geologically, oh, that's interesting, you know, and they raised money, and so they have enough money to drill it. And so that's basically drill results. You know, so if they do hit something, you know, they can raise on the back of it. And that's what happened with HighGold. You know, HighGold last year, you know, they have a known resource at their JT deposit and that, and they were drilling infill holes there, which we're still seeing results from. Very impressive intersections, but it's sort of like known. And so, like you said, it doesn't really move the share price because people already thought that that's what they would get. But when they hit an intersection in a new prospect outside the known resources several kilometers away at Difficult Creek, the share price had a big surge, and then they raised money on the back of it. And they raised enough money that probably fund them for another 2 years of drilling up in Alaska, which is not cheap. So that's what still drives the retail sector, still drives a lot of what's happening is actual results. That'll continue to be a positive. But let's say somebody else does a similar program, drills, they get no results. So now they've spent their money, they've drilled that 5,000 meters, no significant results, they're trading at the same level or less, and now they have to go back to the market. So then the market's saying, well, what do you need? Well, we need another 5,000 meters to do the same thing. And then they're going, well, your first results weren't great. You know, I don't really want to give you money to do that. You got anything else? And then if you're in that situation and you bought shares, the problem with these juniors is the liquidity starts drying up, and then it's harder to get out. It's a bit of a bear trap. Whereas maybe with a bigger company that might have a market cap of more 200 plus million that could raise more capital and drill more meters and, you know, advance the project, that might be less of a reward in terms of share price increase, but downside risk is less and there's less liquidity risk. So if you do sell, you can sell. Whereas that might not be possible with some of these smaller companies. And then that's the sort of problem that you'll have, especially with precious metal juniors into 2022, where the sentiment is more negative.
All right, Joe, we're not going to take up any more of your time, but boy, oh boy, do we appreciate you taking this time with us and really diving into some of these production, development, and then even down into the junior plays. look, I'm sure we all wish that this was just a raging bull market and everything was moving higher, but fact of the matter is there is still opportunity in the sector. You just need to be selective and you need a little bit of luck as well. But understanding, especially from the top down, the majors, developers, what they're going through, because that does trickle down into the juniors as well, plus the whole investment environment right now. Joe, really appreciate your time on this weekend show. Everybody, thanks for listening. Again, please go through our website throughout the week. We had another busy week full of analysis and a lot of company updates. You can always reach out to us, fleck@kereport.com or chat@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you. Joe, everyone else, I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks very much, guys.